Hi, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, founder of Barbell Medicine, and over the last 10 plus years in business, we've built a team of amazing professionals that includes physicians, physical therapists, dietitians, and strength coaches that are available to help you reach your goals. Whether it's strength and muscle gain, weight management, or recovering from an injury, we have some of the best coaches in the game and have worked with people from all walks of life. From teens to grandparents and beginners to elite level athletes, our experienced team of professionals work together to meet you where you're at and give you what you need to succeed. That's the Barbell Medicine difference. If you're not sure exactly what you need, take the quiz linked in the description below or send us an email, support@barbellmedicine.com, and we'll get you sorted. From all of us here at Barbell Medicine, we look forward to hearing from you. We'd love to help. Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength conditioning and strength conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. This is Teaching Rounds, High Blood Pressure Edition. Yeah, that's right. We're going back to the beginning, back to the where it all started on our podcast journey 7 years ago. Dr. Baraki, the second most handsome doctor in North America, is on the other end of the line. Can you believe it's been 7 years since we started this podcast?
Actually, I think I can. It feels like it's been a while.
It feels like that? All right. Maybe I need to work on my personality so we can, you can say, oh, I can't believe it's been 7 years. But
yeah,
millions and millions, if you're a wrestling fan, of downloads later.
Yeah.
We're not resetting and going back to the beginning, but we did think that, you know, a number of our podcasts, sure, new information has popped up, things have changed, so we're going to update them if need be. And we want to summarize these things because just telling people, yeah, go back to the beginning of the podcast, listen to all our stuff, that's not very accessible. It's not a realistic sort of a recommendation, considering we have 320-something episodes or more uploaded on our channel. So we call these teaching rounds. These are effectively summaries. You get the gist. We update stuff that we did before, and these will be made available to our Barbell Medicine Plus subscribers in the future. That'll probably take place around the new year. But for now, we're going to put it on our main feed and let you guys give us some feedback about these episodes. What do you think about them compared to the case, the mystery cases, compared to our normal podcast programming, and so on. So, yeah, teaching rounds. I like that. I like that name. Good suggestion, Dr. Baraki. So, all right, let's get into this. Now, broadly speaking, Dr. Baraki, hypertension, high blood pressure. What percentage of patients would you say that you see in the hospital who have hypertension or high blood pressure?
Yeah, a lot is the answer. I mean, I know that per, you know, the existing data we have, it affects about half of adults in the U.S. However, I have to recognize my selection bias, and the population that I see are selected for or enriched in diseases like high blood pressure. And so I would venture to guess it's upwards of, I don't know, 70%+ of the people that I see or that I would admit who have it.
Yeah, exactly. Like people in the hospital are certainly going to be more likely to have hypertension for sure. But yeah, if you look at all comers in the United States, for example, over half of adults have high blood pressure. And the other kicker about this is that even if they've been diagnosed with hypertension, high blood pressure, less than half of them are being adequately treated, right? So there's a bunch of people who haven't been diagnosed. And of course, they're not being adequately treated. But then there's this other cohort of people who have been diagnosed, who do have access to healthcare and see their provider, but who are inadequately treated. And ultimately, that increases mortality rates. In fact, globally, each year, we attribute about 13% of deaths to high blood pressure. And it's one of those things where you don't necessarily feel bad when you have high blood pressure, but and it takes time for the effects of high blood pressure to take place and accumulate in the body. But yeah, people, by and large, are walking around with an unhealthy blood pressure and not really being appropriately managed. And that, I think that speaks to the difficulty in managing the condition because it's not as simple as, oh, just take this medication and do these lifestyle changes. Sometimes that works, but as we'll see as we go through teaching rounds, it's more complicated than that. All right, so let's back up a little bit. What is high blood pressure? Blood pressure is the force of the moving blood throughout the vessels that is distributed over the surface of the arterial vessels. Based on the current guidelines, which are as recent as 2017 from the American Heart Association and a bunch of other acronymed international and national organizations, normal blood pressure, healthy blood pressure, is less than 120 over 80 millimeters of mercury. And elevated blood pressure is considered to be either a systolic blood pressure between 120 and 129, with a diastolic greater than 80. Stage one hypertension or high blood pressure is systolic blood pressure between 130 and 139 or a diastolic blood pressure between 80 and 89. And then stage two hypertension is a systolic blood pressure of at least 140 millimeters of mercury or a diastolic blood pressure of at least 90 millimeters of mercury. There's a bunch of other categorizations and naming stuff that you can get into, but the key points here is that normal is less than 120 over 80. And then if you get above that, you're either elevated or the individual is a person with hypertension if it's greater than 130 for the systolic blood pressure or greater than 80 on the diastolic blood pressure. Again, it's the bottom number. Now, Austin, how many times in the hospital are you giving people like new diagnoses of hypertension or high blood pressure?
It happens from time to time, but a lot of the time, these patients already have this diagnosis. And I would also say that what's important when it comes to diagnosing it here is you need a properly measured resting blood pressure. And ideally, the person's in their kind of usual state of health. In other words, when people are sick and coming into the hospital for various reasons, they might have elevated blood pressures. They can have very high blood pressures. I just had a patient an hour ago who I saw who was like 190 over 115, but he does not have hypertension. He does not have resting high blood pressure when he is in his usual state of health. He just had an elevation in his blood pressure in the context of what was going on with him. And so that's the key here is that I would be hesitant to even diagnose it in a lot of people while they're admitted and sick, whereas this is more often a diagnosis that is best made as an outpatient or even when you're at home and you have a properly validated, you know, calibrated blood pressure cuff, or you have it done, measured properly outside the context of healthcare and at rest, your resting blood pressure is elevated beyond those thresholds and, you know, oftentimes more on multiple occasions. That would be the most competent way to make this diagnosis accurately.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like if you go into the doctor's office in your usual state of health and your blood pressure is normal, it's less than that 120 over 80, but the rest of the day, for whatever reason, it's actually above that. Technically, we kind of missed, you know, an opportunity to diagnose somebody with elevated blood pressure, which does confer some health risks. So yeah, to your point, if you measure it once, you just get one value, and it kind of depends on what is going on with the person. If they're in pain, for example, their blood pressure is usually going to be typically going to be elevated. If they have a particular medical condition, that can elevate their blood pressure. And so it really depends on the context here. Now, Austin, I'm going to let you talk about these sort of differences. These are like med school, like nerd type of differentiation between primary and secondary hypertension. Just how do you think about those two different types of high blood pressure?
Yeah, this is not something that a patient might need to get into great detail on, but rather it should be something that clinicians are aware of, because if you have somebody in whom you are considering making a diagnosis of hypertension, you ought to think about, is there something identifiable that is causing this that is directly treatable? So conditions where the person's high blood pressure is due to a single identifiable underlying cause, we call that secondary hypertension, meaning that their hypertension is secondary to this other thing. And if I fix that thing, then I can fix the blood pressure. This would be situations like if they're taking certain medicines, stimulants, various other types of drugs that can cause blood pressure to be high, as well as certain other medical conditions affecting the from the kidneys to the thyroid to certain hormone conditions like aldosterone elevations, sleep apnea, things like that, where if I treat that condition, I'll likely make some headway in terms of improving their blood pressure. That's in contrast to situations where there is no identifiable cause for people's high blood pressure. Rather, it's usually the result of a combination of risk factors. This prevalence increases as people get older, as they gain body fat, develop obesity due to genetics, dietary habits, insufficient sleep or physical activity, environmental pollution, various other things that it's not usually just one weird trick that we can handle to fix their blood pressure, but it's usually a combination of all of these things. And sometimes they might not really be treatable, like your age, for example. So that would be more a situation we'd call primary. So every time I, you know, am in a situation where I'm considering making a new diagnosis, I am thinking about and searching for and making sure the patient doesn't have any of those secondary causes. And then once I do that, I'm talking to them about those primary risk factors to see, hey, does everyone in your family that has ever existed have high blood pressure? Probably a genetic component. Tell me about your physical activity. Tell me about your sleep. Tell me about alcohol use. Tell me about various other things that can coalesce to lead to this, to you developing this.
Yeah, this also goes for people who have been previously diagnosed with high blood pressure, for example, and maybe on a medication or more than one medications and are not adequately treated. It kind of gets the wheels turning. Like, is this just a dosage thing that we're not dosing the person with enough medication to get their blood pressure under control? Or was there actually something underlying that we missed? And you know what this sounds like a lot to me is sort of root cause analysis and holistic care. Yeah. So believe it or not, allopathic and osteopathic physicians are trying to do this, especially when it comes to high blood pressure. And one other quick thing I wanted to talk about, because invariably once we talk about elevated blood pressure or high blood pressure, the natural question is going to be, well, what about low blood pressure? So what actually qualifies as hypotension or low blood pressure? And I think you and I kind of respond to this the same way. We're like, coming up with a specific number, for example, it would be deeply satisfying if we could say, look, if your blood pressure is less than 90, that's as the top number on systolic blood pressure, or it's less than 70 on the lower number, that maybe qualifies as hypotension. But that's really not how we think about hypotension. Austin, you see this a lot more in the hospital than folks in outpatient setting. What do you think about when you think about hypotension, so low blood pressure?
Yeah, I think about it in terms of the consequences more than the number. And so, you know, we need pressure of our blood flow to get oxygenated blood to organs. And if you don't have enough pressure to get that oxygenated blood to the organ, then the organ will start to become dysfunctional or fail. And so if I have a patient with low blood pressure of any degree, and I see evidence of their organs failing or not working correctly, potentially due to that low blood pressure, then that would be a type of hypotension that I care about, that I'm concerned about, for example. In contrast, there are various situations where a patient might have a low resting blood pressure that might tempt you to diagnose it as hypotension. Yet, when you do an assessment of all of their organs, their brain, their kidneys, their liver, that measure a blood lactate level, all sorts of various other markers of, is enough oxygenated blood getting to these organs? It all looks normal. And so I've just had two of these situations literally within the past 2 days in the hospital. I saw a woman this morning whose resting blood pressure right now, it was like 81 over 50. She has some medical conditions going on that are contributing to that. However, she has no evidence of consequences from that. She can stand up. She's not lightheaded. Her lactic acid level was like 0.6, very low. Her kidneys are fine. Her liver's, all this stuff's fine. So I just said, oh, okay, I guess you're all right. In contrast, if I saw that in almost anybody else, I would say, oh, this person is either in shock or in impending shock, and I need to immediately administer them medicines to raise their blood pressure. So really, it's a tricky thing for people to figure out for themselves. But if you have low numbers that strike you as low, but you feel completely fine, then you're probably fine. Usually, those patients don't feel great when they have hypotension. That's a problem.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of interesting because your run-of-the-mill hypertension, particularly somebody with chronic resting high blood pressure, they tend to not feel its effects, even when the numbers can get scary. You know, I've had people, they measure their blood pressure and it's 180 over 100 or something. Like, I have to go to the emergency room right now, right? Like, I'm going to blow a blood vessel. It's like, actually, this is not generally an emergency. But if your blood pressure is too low, you do start to feel crummy. And so that's kind of like the tip-off there. So, we discussed this on three separate podcasts, podcast number two, podcast 177, 178. All of those are linked in the description below. But this, again, is teaching rounds, sort of summary of those podcasts and any additional updates that we've come up with in the 7-year history of the Barbell Medicine podcast. So now that we have some definitions out of the way, some nomenclature out of the way, let's start talking about diagnosing high blood pressure or hypertension. So the first thing, you kind of alluded to this earlier, Dr. Baraki, is taking a good blood pressure. So the general process here is that you want the resting blood pressure to be taken appropriately and in the right location and under the right circumstances. So you want the blood pressure taken at the level of the heart in the arm, because you could take a blood pressure from various other sources. You could take a blood pressure in somebody's head, for example, or their foot, and it's going to give you wildly different readings, which ultimately you kind of shrug at and you're like, I'm not sure what this means unless I'm trying to make sure that that particular area of the body is being perfused with blood. So the current recommendation is to have blood pressure measured every year for individuals who are otherwise healthy without a history of high blood pressure. So this is one of those few screening tests that Dr. Baraki gets really excited about. He's like, look, man, I don't care about your boron levels or your red blood cell magnesium levels, for example, so much unless there's a specific reason to investigate those things. But blood pressure, you better be getting your blood pressure taken every year, even if you're otherwise healthy. Now, if you are an individual with high blood pressure or hypertension, and or you have other risk factors that would increase your likelihood of having that. So things like obesity, for example, if you have kidney disease, for example, type 2 diabetes, these sort of things that sort of elevate the suspicion that either you might be developing high blood pressure or you'd be at significantly higher risk from having these two conditions together, at least biannually. So twice per year is sort of the recommendation. And that to me seems a little low, but that's the current recommendation from a screening perspective. Okay, so that's a frequency of screening. Next is how do you actually do it? So you need to, this is usually happens in a medical office for most folks. You should be sitting comfortably for at least 5 minutes quietly. No recent exercise or smoking within the 30 minutes prior to this blood pressure being taken, because those things can actually artificially elevate blood pressure. So don't, you know, if you're late for the doctor's appointment, yes, get to the lobby, yes, sign in, but, you know, maybe wait for that blood pressure to be taken if you just sprinted up the stairs, for example. Also, an empty bladder, yes, having a full bladder and having and holding it and going to the bathroom, that's kind of a pain response that can increase the blood pressure measurement. If you're talking, that can also increase the blood pressure measurement. I know a lot of people want to be polite, but this is a time where silence is golden. And also to make sure that the cuff is properly sized. Now, if you're listening to the Barbell Medicine podcast, I assume that you do some resistance training. And so it is possible that you get to kind of flex on people, not literally, of course, but you say, I might need a bigger cuff. And so the bladder on the actual cuff itself should encircle at least 80% of the arm. I don't think you need to bring a protractor out or some other measurement device, but making sure that you have the right size cuff, and you might have to remind the medical staff if you do if you are packing guns. I think that's, they usually are up on that, but just to make sure that you have the right size cuff. Also, your feet should be on the floor, legs uncrossed, seated in a chair. These are all things that if you don't do, can give you sort of this, you know, less accurate sort of reading. And also repeating the measurement can be skewed as well if you're doing it under different circumstances. Finally, blood pressure should be measured in both arms. And we tend to use the arm with the higher reading if there is a difference going forward. Again, most people have this measured when they're in the sort of healthcare setting. So they're in the doctor's office, for example, or in the hospital, God forbid. But you can also do it at home. And Austin, you've done some research into not only where can you get like a calibrated blood pressure measuring device, but also there's some interesting nuances there about measuring this at home. So why don't you tell our listeners about home blood pressure measurement?
Yeah, home blood pressure measurements have actually come into favor in recent years. They have now become preferred as a way to get more high quality and accurate data for blood pressure monitoring and management, assuming you can actually do the measurement correctly, as we just outlined, seated, back supported, legs uncrossed, feet flat on the floor, resting quietly for several minutes, cuff at the right height, right size for your arm, all of those things that you just went over. They're so important that I had to say them again. Yet, the other thing that you would need is to use a device that is properly calibrated. And so the resource that I have previously recommended and referenced in my article on this topic is called validatebp.org. And that's a U.S. kind of a listing of validated blood pressure machines that are kind of more properly calibrated. Now, if you go to a doctor's office and get your blood pressure measured there too, it can often be helpful to bring the machine and see how well they correlate when they're measured in that context. But that is a resource that I often recommend if patients are looking for, hey, what kind of machine do you recommend at home? I just use that resource and say, hey, this is the place where you should go and use one of these, and I would trust that listing. And then if you're going to do measurements at home, there's been some research into this. How do we get the most high quality data to work off of? Because again, just one data point is one data point. And so you can get pretty high quality information if you do 3 days of measurements where you take two blood pressures in the morning and two blood pressures in the evening on each day. That sounds like a lot, and it kind of is, but it's only for 3 days. And this is actually a little bit less onerous than the more traditional way of hooking somebody up to a blood pressure monitor that they maintain, that they're wearing 24 hours a day for a while, or for a day to a couple days, and then return that device. So this is a way to kind of estimate or mimic that level of quality measurement.
Yep. Yeah, and there are different cutoffs that physicians, your doctor, will use based on home data that's collected versus data collected in the medical office. But yeah, the ambulatory blood pressure monitoring stuff, you know, people. You know, when you're looking at the results with your physician, it's wearing it while you're exercising, you wear it while you sleep. And there's, you know, it can be difficult to interpret that compared to sort of these isolated measurements if they're done under the right context, which again, you previously discussed. So sitting quietly, resting beforehand, feet up flat on the floor, sitting in a chair, you know, taking it at the right level, using a validated cuff with the right, a validated machine with the right size cuff, all of those things are important. All right. So now that we have an idea of not only how to diagnose high blood pressure and hypertension, also how to actually take the measurement, let's start talking about why this is such a big deal. Because again, it doesn't really cause symptoms in most people having high blood pressure. Again, most people don't feel particularly bad. So a large proportion of folks are walking around and don't even know that they have this, particularly if they're not regularly engaging or interfacing with the healthcare system. It is the most prevalent risk factor, high blood pressure is, for premature heart disease or cardiovascular disease that is modifiable, meaning that we can do something about it. It's more common than other risk factors like cigarette smoking, which I think about 15% of the United States adult population still smokes, high cholesterol, for example, type 2 diabetes, and so on. So it's the most prevalent risk factor for premature heart disease that we can actually do something about. Now, Austin, there's a long history here of like blood pressure and like what are normal amounts and like what it, does this actually cause problems or is this a normal consequence of aging, right? I remember my longitudinal preceptor in medical school, he was like, yeah, back when I was going through medical school, it was just 100 plus your age. That's what we thought your systolic blood pressure should be. And now we got all these newfangled numbers. And I'm like, I should probably verify that, but you've done some digging here on the research on like the history of high blood pressure. So why don't you tell the listeners about that and why this is such an important risk factor to treat from a complication standpoint?
Yeah, the way that people have thought about this over time has definitely changed. And it probably was, you know, more recent than people realize as to when we started to really recognize it from the 1950s and 60s, where it started to be kind of thought about in this way. And some randomized trials were done looking at what happens if we actually treat people with this. The medicines that we used at the time, I will say, were very primitive and in no way as good as what we have nowadays. Most of them are no longer used for anything. But a few of them actually do still exist. And so one study from 1967 randomized a cohort of folks at the VA who had very high blood pressure. Their diastolic, meaning the lower number, was between 115 to 129. Again, that's a number that we would often prefer be the higher number, and it was actually their bottom number. So their top number was substantially even higher than that. And they randomized this group of veterans to either take blood pressure lowering medicines or placebo for a year and a half. And now, because of how well established it is that is insane to let people live with that, this trial would never be done anymore because it'd be way too risky to let people live for a year and a half with untreated diastolic blood pressures that high. But we didn't know that at the time. And so that was what this study did. There were 4 deaths in the group that got placebo and none in the group that were treated. There were 27 quote unquote morbid events like heart attacks and strokes in the group that got placebo and only 2 in the treatment arm. So in just a year and a half, this was an enormous effect on the risk of cardiovascular complications like heart attack and stroke. And so that kind of kicked things off from there. And so from that point, you know, we knew that taking somebody from extremely high blood pressure to just, you know, even a little bit lower blood pressure, you get a massive return on that investment. And it took many more years/decades up until, you know, within the past decade to establish like how low can we go and keep getting benefit. And so that's kind of the territory that we find ourselves arguing and debating and going back and forth in, is how low should we push people's blood pressure? What demographics, you know, benefit in older folks? How low should we push them before they start to get too dizzy and fall and, you know, have off target kind of harms for other reasons? Because there are data like a giant meta-analysis of over 1 million adults from which we establish that cardiovascular risk starts to go up in all age groups as your blood pressure starts to go over 115 for the top number or over 75 for the bottom number. So you would think that, hey, that means that if I'm to push people's blood pressure down to that level of 115 over 75, that would optimize their cardiovascular risk. And it may. There is, you know, evidence that we get continued benefit from lowering people's blood pressure down to that level. We just start to get more and more side effects and harms in certain populations when we push it down that low. So that's where this ends up being an individualized kind of conversation. The lower you can get it through lifestyle means, that's great. But when it comes to the discussion about medicines, multiple medicines, higher doses of medicines, then we start having more conversations about the trade-offs of getting your resting blood pressure down another, you know, 3 points to theoretically give you a tiny bit more, you know, diminishing returns worth of benefit in terms of your stroke risk versus the risk of making you get lightheaded and dizzy when you stand up and fall and other problems like that.
Yeah. So it's just one of those things that the higher it is, generally speaking, and the longer it's elevated, generally speaking, the worse off that is for health. Now, at the margins, so when you start talking about getting right around that 120 zone or lower, and you have to use multiple agents, for example, the calculus can change depending on the actual demographics. But yeah, that's where the arguments are taking place. Nobody's arguing that, let's just not treat high blood pressure. It's all good. Not worry about it. Nobody is saying that who is familiar with the current evidence. It's more so of when do you start treatment and when do you stop sort of increasing the intensity of the treatment. That again, on the margins. And we'll know more as more and more data comes out. But I know from myself, personally speaking, that if I had elevated blood pressure, elevated resting blood pressure above 120, I would be pretty aggressive at getting that down. Whether it's through lifestyle alone or whether I would need some medications to do so, I would not let myself just hang out, you know, in the mid 120s and certainly higher than that without and just say, I'm fine. I think that used to be what happened, especially prior to the 2017 guidelines where they kind of lowered that sort of permissive high blood pressure in otherwise healthy individuals. Before, if you went in, it was 2016, you go in the doctor's office and your blood pressure is 125 over 85. And they're like, that's probably fine. Now it should raise some eyebrows, particularly for younger individuals, because again, it's that cumulative sort of exposure to elevated blood pressure. In a nonagenarian, you know, you might not blink at that because you're like, well, we don't really know in this particular patient population. But if you're in your 30s, I think that's different. Does that sort of jibe with your understanding?
Yeah, very similar to how we talk about blood lipids. The higher it is, the longer it's elevated for, the higher amount of risk that confers. So we definitely think about lower, more modest high blood pressure differently in a teenager than I would in a 85-year-old, just like I would think about, you know, more modest elevations in blood cholesterol differently in a teenager or a 20-year-old than I would in an 80 or 90-year-old for sure.
All right, well, let's start talking about treatment then, and we'll start off with this. Hey, everyone. I hope that you're enjoying the podcast. I just wanted to remind you that we have launched our Barbell Medicine Plus option in order to help support what we do here on the podcast and beyond. Now, Plus members get early access to our podcast, ad-free listening, written transcripts and summaries, videos, exclusive access to a members-only podcast where Dr. Baraki and I answer your questions directly, and more exclusive content as well. If you want to support what we're doing and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Barbell Medicine Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus. And just think, no more of these ads. Thanks for your support. Now back to the podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Incogni. Anyone who's been on the internet knows that online privacy and data protection is a big problem. Every year, both the number and severity of personal data compromise goes up. And according to the 2022 annual data breach report by Identity Theft Resource Center, the number of victims has gone up by nearly 41.5% from 2021. In the US in particular, there's a big problem where people search individual websites to create detailed personal profiles on millions of Americans and publish them online for anyone to see. The bad news is that your personal information is probably being sold or published online without you even knowing it. The good news is you have the right to protect your privacy and request that data brokers delete the information that they hold about you. Let Incogni do the work for you. Incogni reaches out to data brokers on your behalf, requests your personal data removal, and deals with any objections from their side. It's easy to sign up, and once you do, the entire process is automated. Incogni also keeps you updated about the progress. They're also offering Barbell Medicine listeners a promotional rate to get started. Use promo code Barbell at the link incogni.com/barbell to get an exclusive 60% off an annual plan. That's incogni.com/barbell to get 60% off your annual plan to protect your privacy. Go incognito with Incogni. While we all know that nutrition is huge when it comes to health and performance, we don't always have time to shop for and prepare healthy meals. The days are getting shorter, but your to-do lists aren't. So instead of reaching for your phone to order out or heading to the nearest restaurant, let Factor help you take the stress out of eating healthy this fall. Skip the grocery stores, the prep work, and the cooking fatigue, and instead get chef-crafted, dietitian-approved meals delivered right to your door. Factor lets you choose from a ton of different meal plans, including everything from vegan to high-protein options. Find guilt-free comfort foods like homestyle chicken and gravy and loaded mashed potato pork chops. Also feel-good vegan options like sweet potato and chickpea curry and gourmet plus dishes like truffle butter filet mignon. When things get hectic, Factor is flexible. You can change your order up every week with plans from 4 to 18 meals per week, or pause or reschedule your deliveries anytime. If you want a helping hand with your nutrition, head to factormeals.com/BBM50 and use code BBM50 to get 50% off. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/BBM50 to get 50% off. This podcast is brought to you by Rosetta Stone. If you've been listening to our podcast for a while, you know that I'd previously been trying to learn French using Babbel, a direct competitor to Rosetta Stone. And while I had a good experience with Babbel getting ready for this trip, Rosetta Stone offers 12 more languages than Babbel, including many Asian languages that Babbel does not. Additionally, Rosetta Stone is offering 50% off a lifetime membership, which is an incredible deal and basically forced me to let them sponsor this podcast. Now, Rosetta Stone is one of the most trusted language learning programs in the last 30 years, with millions of users and 25 languages offered. It's also available on desktop or as an app, so you can learn anywhere. And it uses an immersive experience to help you learn the language of your choice quickly, along with using the correct accent using its speech recognition technology. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Barbell Medicine listeners can get Rosetta Stone lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get 50% off unlimited access to 25 different language courses for life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today and get started.
Non-pharmaceutical treatment, so lifestyle type stuff. First off, we'll start with the diet. So in general, this should be a surprise to absolutely no one, particularly if you've listened to the Barbell Medicine podcast before. We want folks to eat a generally healthy, health-promoting dietary pattern. A lot of people want to focus on micronutrients, you know, specifically sodium, potassium, and we will talk about those. But generally speaking, if you can get folks to eat a minimally processed or unprocessed dietary pattern, rich in lean protein, fruits, vegetables, legumes, whole grains, et cetera, the micronutrient thing is going to work itself out, mainly because the foods that tend to be high in sodium, for example, are also high in calories, which would generally not support anybody's sort of body weight and body composition goals from a health perspective, and also would tend to not support otherwise a healthy dietary pattern. Just you wouldn't have a lot of ultra-processed foods in that have a lot of added sodium. So again, rather than starting with this hyper-fixation on micronutrients, I would start looking at the whole dietary pattern, see what sort of opportunities we have to modify that, and then you can sort of get down to the nitty-gritty. So generally speaking, replacing hyper-processed, hyper-palatable foods with vegetables, fruits, legumes, nuts, whole grains, dairy products, and lean sources of protein like fish. Excellent strategy to lower sodium intake because it's going to, and it's going to tend to lower calorie intake as well. And the two biggest drivers of sodium intake, which we're about to talk about, are total calorie intake and the level of processing in the food. So let's move on. We'll talk about sodium here. And I'll be the first to admit that we have definitely said some things based on previous data that made it look like the relationship between dietary sodium intake and sort of health trajectory was maybe less nefarious, I think, than our current stance, meaning that we were kind of, I don't know that people should really lower their sodium intake. That's probably not the big driver in most folks of high blood pressure, but that tends to be more of an artifact of the way that we were not only measuring sodium intake, but also, how much people were actually getting out through their kidneys. You could take like a spot urine check, for example, to see, just how much sodium this person was generally eating based on this single sort of value in their urine versus a 24-hour collection of their sodium that's in the urine. And then you have a much more accurate look at like, this is how much sodium the person was not only eating, but also like filtering out. And so that gives you a more in-depth look at like, yep, here's how much sodium they were actually eating and here's the subsequent effect. So based on the most recent data here, through multiple lines of evidence, so that's different types of studies using 24-hour collections of urinary sodium content, as well as intervention data where people limit how much sodium they're taking. The current guidelines are less than 2,400 milligrams of sodium per day. The general population eats way more than that, closer to 3,400, 3,500 milligrams per day. We know that when people go above that level, their blood pressure tends to go up. When people want to argue about that, it's kind of like a point at the scoreboard sort of thing. It's like, where's the data? And invariably, this is going to come back to people who are otherwise healthy right now, who currently don't have high blood pressure, or elevated blood pressure. And they're like, well, look, all these people are telling me to eat more salt. It's a good pre-workout or whatever. Or I sweat a lot. Like, you're telling me not to eat more sodium. Hey, your pre-workout even has some extra sodium in it. What do? And I will be the first to admit that is a unique, relatively niche sort of population. Like, okay, otherwise healthy person, healthy body composition, healthy body weight, very active, sweats a lot. Should you be consuming more sodium? Likely.
as far as replacing that. And then the second part is, if you carry more muscle mass, you're going to need to eat more calories to support that muscle mass. And again, we know that calorie intake is directly related to sodium intake, even if you eat a minimally processed or otherwise unprocessed dietary pattern. So yeah, that is like a small population that we don't really know the effects there. But I will tell you, of the, you know, we get a couple hundred thousand downloads per month of our podcast, I would estimate that a relatively small fraction of the people listening to our podcast, which is an even smaller proportion of the general public, that it's just such a small portion of folks. I don't know that it's relatively good advice to tell people to consume more sodium, you know, as like a pre-workout, or like they need it because they're training so hard that they need to replace these things. And like now, rather than, okay, look, over the next 24 hours after a workout where you sweat a lot, a high sodium excretion, high sweat rate. You're probably going to eat food. You're probably going to drink things, and you're likely going to be fine. So, Austin, does that kind of square with your experience? Is like, should we be telling folks to consume more sodium based on the existing evidence?
I don't think we should say that uncaveated, and you just added the necessary caveats. And so I think that, you know, there is a population that stands to benefit from that. I myself have stood to benefit from that from doing a lot of hard training in, you know, peak summer hot Texas garage, and I'm, you know, drenched in sweat and stuff like that. So that's certainly a scenario where I would think about it, but I would not put out that recommendation broadly speaking and just say like, you know, everyone's lying to you. Everybody needs way more sodium in their diet, because that's not really applicable to the majority of the population. But when it's more targeted towards this particular niche context, then certainly, but it just needs to be caveated appropriately.
Yeah. And if you do have elevated blood pressure or hypertension, I would definitely ignore that recommendation to consume more sodium, because it's not like you're consuming too little sodium and that's why you have high blood pressure. There's not this sort of like reciprocal effect there. So anyway, based on the best data we have right now, it seems like the sodium guidelines are reasonable to consume less than 2,400 milligrams of sodium per day. Again, that's mostly related to calorie intake and the level of processing in the food, in the dietary pattern. So a minimally processed, unprocessed dietary pattern at the right calorie level is likely going to result in that. I think the current evidence suggests that the average intake per 1,000 calories is about 1,600 milligrams of sodium. So you can imagine that if a person is eating 3,000 calories per day, that means they're taking in, you know, what is that, 4,800 milligrams of sodium per day, almost double the guidelines recommendations, which would be far too much. So yeah, easiest strategy here as far as limiting sodium: reduce overall energy intake, especially if you would also benefit from weight loss, reduced processed hyperpalatable foods in favor of minimally processed or unprocessed foods, and increase the intake of vegetables and potassium-rich foods, which is actually the next micronutrient we're going to talk about, is potassium. So these are mostly contained in fruits and vegetables. So we're thinking about things like spinach, avocado, sweet potato, bok choy, white beans, beets, Brussels sprouts, broccoli, cantaloupe, and bananas. Increasing potassium intake through these methods seems to offset sodium intake, usually from replacing foods that would otherwise have high levels of sodium. And again, that's more of a broader change to the dietary pattern rather than a specific focus on, hey, I might have more potassium. But if you were trying to eat more potassium, and most folks are not eating enough potassium because most people don't eat enough vegetables, those would be the vegetables that I would be recommending. So spinach, again, sweet potato, other potatoes, Brussels sprouts, broccoli, et cetera. And most forms of fruit also have a decent dose of potassium. Okay, so that's our first sort of non-pharmaceutical treatment. The second one's going to be exercise. And, you know, this is one of those paradoxes. And I like the way you explain this, Austin, so I'm going to let you kind of go off on this. Because look, we're talking about exposure to high blood pressure, and generally speaking, for a long period of time, that's bad. We just said that. And then there's like this dose-dependent relationship. The higher it is and the longer it stays elevated, well, that's all bad news. But what about during exercise? Now look, like we've measured blood pressure very, very accurately when people are doing near one rep max leg presses and their blood pressure is in, you know, 480 over 350, which if that does come up on your reading, on your at-home blood pressure monitor, I would, at that point, I would probably go to the hospital. I think that's a good idea. But what gives? Is it okay to have high blood pressure when you're exercising versus at rest? What's the difference there?
Yeah, I mean, I think you said it there when you said the higher it is and the longer it's elevated for. And when you think about those instantaneous brief elevations that happen to that level during strength exercise, That's very, very minimal. And additionally, the context is different in terms of how you got there. It is through exertion that is brief and then kind of remits afterwards. And our cardiovascular system experiences that as a rep, just like you experience it as a rep when you're lifting weights. And there is some adaptation that happens in the blood vessels themselves, their kind of capacitance and elasticity and things like that. And so ultimately, this can lead to some beneficial adaptations that improve blood pressure regulation. And so we really talk about it a ton in terms of blood pressure matters in terms of how you got there. If we, in the same way, instead of doing a rep on the squat, we just loaded up 405 on your back and you just lived with it for 40 years, you would probably not end up feeling awesome at the at the end of it. In the same way that having a persistent blood pressure of 155 over 95 for those 40 years is not going to do you well from a health standpoint. But those brief bouts of it generate completely different effects and adaptations and responses.
Yeah. Yeah, well said. So again, it matters how you got there. And look, there are no forms of exercise that result in a decrease in blood pressure while you're doing the thing. So all exercise increases blood pressure while you're doing it. So it's not something that's possible to, you know, initiate exercise, participate in exercise, and also, you know, lower your blood pressure while you're doing it. In fact, we're mostly concerned with your resting blood pressure, which, as we stated in the initial part of this, is measured about 30 minutes or more after you're done exercising. So the best data we have on like the effect of exercise on elevated blood pressure comes from a study by Nacy et al. I believe this was in 2018. The total amount of subjects enrolled in this meta-analysis of 391 studies, half of them comparing exercise and its effect on folks with high blood pressure, and the other half affect using medications to treat high blood pressure. So 40,000 people, 391 studies, again, half on exercise, half on medications. All right. When we look at just the effect on resting blood pressure in those who have a systolic, that's the top number, who have a systolic blood pressure of greater than 140 millimeters of mercury, the data on average showed a decrease from exercise of about 8.9 millimeters of mercury. And how that shakes out with respect to different types of exercise: endurance exercise lowered systolic blood pressure, again, that's the top number, by about 8.6. Resistance training, just lifting weights, lowered systolic blood pressure by about 7.8 in these individuals. And combined endurance and resistance training, so concurrent training, lowered systolic blood pressure by 13.5. By 13.5. Okay, that's a big reduction in blood pressure. Now, you can find other studies that will say far less than that. They'll say, oh, exercise on average will lower resting blood pressure by about 4 millimeters of mercury. And you're like, that doesn't seem like 13.5, like Dr. Feigenbaum just said. What gives? Well, that is the lowering of blood pressure in not only folks with high blood pressure, but also normal blood pressure. They're looking at all comers. And so it is true, exercise will lower your blood pressure a little bit if you have normal blood pressure, a few millimeters of mercury. That's good. You're getting closer to that 115 level that we're kind of targeting it, particularly in younger individuals who don't have other health conditions. All right. So that's the deal on exercise. I would be remiss if I didn't mention isometrics, because there's been some new emerging data on how isometrics, that's when you're not actually moving when you're applying force to an external resistance. Isometrics can lower blood pressure. That is another available form or mode of exercise that you can use to lower blood pressure. And it does seem to work pretty well. The problem is we don't know if it also confers the additional benefits from exercise to the rest of the body. So bone mineral density, for example, increased muscular hypertrophy, muscle size, increased muscular strength in dynamic movements where you're actually moving and interacting with the environment. It's possible and it's likely, in fact, that there's a non-zero improvement in those things. But is it as good as other types of exercise, traditional resistance training? That is up for debate. I suspect not, but I would be remiss if I didn't say that isometrics are an option, particularly for folks who can't exercise, quote, normally. I think that'd be my sort of use case there. All right. So again, combined resistance training and endurance training lowers blood pressure in those with high blood pressure, greater than 140 for the top number, by about 13.5 millimeters of mercury on average. Big effect. Now, in that same group, 194 antihypertensive medication randomized controlled trials, including only those with high blood pressure, the systolic blood pressure, that's the top number, was lowered by 8.8 millimeters of mercury on average. And so if you were just tuned in right now And you're like, damn, it seems like exercise is really impressive, really, really good at lowering blood pressure. Yeah, you would be correct. It's a very potent, powerful lever that we can pull if some people are willing to do it and able to do it, particularly at a level where they get better at doing the exercise. There's additional data showing that those who actually get stronger from doing exercise see a greater reduction in blood pressure compared to those who still exercise and lift weights but don't actually get stronger. I think there's some overlap between performance adaptations and fitness adaptations, maybe using some shared machinery there. Also, to the extent that exercise supports weight loss, we know that weight loss itself can improve resting blood pressure. That's the same thing with the dietary pattern. If you start eating the correct amount of calories and you lose excess body fat, that tends to also decrease blood pressure in addition to those sort of micronutrient changes that we mentioned between sodium and potassium. Too long, didn't listen. Exercise is good. Duh. There's a few other sort of lifestyle or non-pharmaceutical things that we can intervene on that would otherwise lower resting blood pressure. Austin, you want to summarize those for folks?
Yeah. So sleep is something I ask everybody about as not only in a general health consultation, but definitely when it comes to blood pressure, both their general sleep habits, their sleep hygiene, and then how much sleep they get kind of on average, because insufficient sleep duration, restricted sleep duration is something that can increase blood pressure. And then also I will do a preliminary screen for their risk of having obstructive sleep apnea, which is a problem relating to disordered breathing while you were asleep at night. If anybody has ever heard of this, it's a condition where you can intermittently stop breathing and your system kind of responds by revving up a little bit, and that can contribute to elevations in blood pressure. Now, treating sleep apnea is often insufficient to completely fix somebody's high blood pressure, but there's oftentimes multiple things that can be addressed. Maybe there's also obesity, maybe there's other things going on. But if you go to a website called stopbang.ca, I think it's stop-bang.ca, you just Google stopbang. That is the screening questionnaire for sleep apnea, and see if you are high enough risk to merit screening. It can make you feel a lot better, and it can help improve various things about your life, to include your energy, your mood, and your blood pressure, to name just a few. And then finally, various substances can contribute to increases in blood pressure. Smoking cigarettes, habitual use of alcohol, and then certain drugs and medications. And this can be illicit drugs, obviously, like big time stimulants and things like that, but also certain medicines that are prescribed for potentially valid reasons. Decongestants like Sudafed, for example, have vasoconstricting effect that can elevate blood pressure. The stimulants that we use to treat attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. There are certain weight loss medicines, to include bupropion or phentermine, many others that can contribute to elevations in blood pressure. And so those would be things to look at and think about. So that's just a brief overview. We have more detail on this in our dedicated content on this on the website as well.
Yep. Those all will be linked in the description below. So the three previous podcasts, in addition to our article. And again, this is going to be one of those episodes that in the future, we'll probably leave this on the main feed, but we're going to be doing these style of episodes for our Barbell Medicine Plus subscribers. Again, as sort of any sort of updates that are out there, and then also any sort of these summaries we think are high yield for folks. All right. Last thing before we wrap this up. We're going to talk about medications. Now, again, no conflict of interest to declare from either of us. Big Pharma is not paying us to say this, but for individuals who have been diagnosed with high blood pressure, hypertension, and are doing the lifestyle stuff as hard as they can, they've been thoroughly evaluated, so there's no other secondary cause that can be intervened upon, medication is the next step in the sort of algorithm here, okay? And some new guidelines actually just came out from the European Society of Cardiology as recent as September 2024. So that's, a few months ago. They recommend initiating medication if systolic blood pressure is greater than 140, that's the top number, or diastolic, the bottom number, is greater than 90 in the office, or if systolic blood pressure is greater than 130, or diastolic blood pressure is greater than 80, if the patient is at otherwise high risk for heart disease. So this would be somebody who's got type 2 diabetes, for example, or who has high blood lipids, high blood cholesterol, or some other sort of medical condition that is currently known and then knows that it increases their cardiovascular risk. These are from the European Society of Cardiology. They also recommend an initial sort of medication therapy, not just one agent, but multiple agents. And this is something you've kind of spoken about in a few of our podcasts, not only on this topic, but just sort of optimizing cardiovascular risk profile. Austin, why don't you walk people through that sort of clinical decision-making of starting multiple agents versus just one agent?
Yeah, I'm glad the guidelines are finally catching up to me there, among other people who have been doing this for a long time now. So the idea, historically, like when I went through training for various conditions to include blood pressure or blood cholesterol, or when we were treating heart failure, things like that, there are certain medicines that are options to you or that might be recommended. And we would usually start one medicine for convenience, and then we would if it was insufficient, we would crank the dose up all the way to the maximum over a period of time before we would consider starting a second medication. This took a while, and it often led to people living with these conditions for longer than they needed to. And additionally, the higher you go on the dose of medicines, not only do you get diminishing effects that on the thing you care about, like blood pressure lowering, but then you get increasing risk of side effects at the highest doses. And so the trade-off gets worse and worse the higher you go on a given medicine. Now, plenty of patients tolerate the maximum doses of these medicines just fine. So I don't want to scare anybody who's listening away from saying, oh, well, my doctor put me on 40 milligrams of lisinopril and that's the max and that's the bad idea. It's not necessarily bad. Plenty of people tolerate it just fine. However, what the guidelines are now coming around to is recognizing that for most of these conditions, blood pressure, blood lipids, various other conditions, we get the biggest bang for our buck from just starting the lowest dose of a particular medicine. And you get diminishing returns from going up in dose while potential side effect risk goes up. And so we can get bigger bangs for our buck by starting more than one medicine at the lowest possible dose to get that biggest bang from medicines that work in different ways. Because people can have high blood pressure by different mechanisms, and different medicines that work by different mechanisms, if I start more than one, I'm more likely to hit your mechanism of high blood pressure, and I'm going to get the biggest bang for my buck with the lowest dose and spare you the potential risk of having any side effects by cranking it all the way up to the maximum dose. Now, if I have to get to the max dose, I have to. I give an example. I have a gentleman who I take care of via telemedicine who's relatively young, lean, healthy, active, great diet, meets all the physical activity guidelines, sleeps well, doesn't use any drugs, substances, alcohol, anything else. He has had raging high blood pressure from when I started working with him. I searched every possible secondary cause of hypertension that I could find, found nothing. To get another opinion, I referred him to a hypertension specialist who was basically like, yeah, agree with the evaluation you've done so far. Good job, right? And I had ultimately started him on four different blood pressure medicines. And again, this was, of course, striking to somebody who was in that demographic, who's young and healthy, and suddenly I have this condition that's needing all these medicines to treat. But he had a good understanding of what we were dealing with and how important it was to get blood pressure under control. And he kind of drew the short end of the stick, whether it's genetic, some heritable, something like that, that's not identifiable. And so he ended up on four low dose medicines and then increased the dose of them over time until we managed to get control. And so this is a pattern that's coming out in various areas of practice where initial combination therapy at low doses is the way to go for people who are willing to take more than one pill unless it comes in a combination pill product.
Yeah. Again, sounds like holistic medicine to me. You're trying to, through all the potential mechanisms that an individual may be experiencing high blood pressure from, you're trying to, get each one of them rather than just one and then up the dose. So, pretty cool. Glad the guidelines are finally updated. All right, well, let's wrap this up. Let's summarize. So I think we've had three podcasts on this, episode 2, episode 177, episode 178. We also have an article. All of those are linked in the show notes below. But the summary here, first off, got to talk about screening and diagnosing. Everybody should be getting their blood pressure measured every year at a minimum. That assumes you have no other medical condition that you would be require more sort of testing to see how your blood pressure is doing. So at least once a year, otherwise at least twice per year if you are an individual who's previously been diagnosed with high blood pressure or otherwise are at high risk of cardiovascular disease. As far as doing something about it, exercise is a very powerful tool that we can use, particularly when we combine both strength training and endurance training together. One isn't better than the other. Would recommend both, and that is consistent with the current exercise guidelines. Would plan on doing both types of exercise. It's ideally best if you're actually improving in exercise rather than just participating, but hey, I'll settle for just participation. When it comes to the dietary pattern, we want to address high blood pressure through multiple different mechanisms. One is going to be through weight loss if an individual needs it. The second is going to be through dietary pattern, a more health-promoting dietary pattern, to include more high-fiber foods, less processed foods. All of those things would tend to reduce sodium intake and tend to increase potassium intake. Okay, and then as far as micromanaging sodium and potassium levels, would generally recommend against adding more high-sodium foods into the diet. Most of the dietary sodium intake is not coming from the salt shaker. It's coming from the processing level of food and the amount of calories that somebody is consuming. So shoring up those two things and then focusing on eating more vegetables, particularly those with high potassium, would be the dietary pattern recommendation. Next,
would be body fat management. Now, this, again, can be addressed through exercise, through diet, through other lifestyle changes. But medications may be an option, may be necessary for some folks to lose body fat because obesity is a strong risk factor for elevated blood pressure and hypertension. And if lifestyle and medication alone won't work, bariatric or metabolic surgery may be an option. We will discuss this in future podcasts as we have in the past. Next is going to be sleep. Again, more lifestyle change. So not only sleep quantity, so how long someone's sleeping, but also sleep quality, to include things like obstructive sleep apnea and other sort of parasomnias. Would definitely want to make sure to be asking about sleep in individuals. Alcohol intake, smoking, and other sort of substances, those things generally increase the risk and magnitude of elevated blood pressure and hypertension. And then finally, we'd be thinking about investigating secondary causes for elevated blood pressure and hypertension. So that's screening for things like kidney function, thyroid function, aldosterone levels, and a number of other things that no matter how much medication a person's on, they may not still be able to reach the sort of goal blood pressure target because there is something else brewing underneath the hood. If an individual does need medication, as Austin just described so eloquently, there are specific medications listed in the article that he wrote. But again, it is more favorable currently and based on guidelines to start with a combination of medicines at lower doses than starting with a single agent and maximizing that, unless, again, that's the only thing that somebody can take or will take. There's obviously some patient preferences that need to be weighed out there. Dr. Baraki, anything you want to add to this sort of teaching rounds on hypertension?
Please get your blood pressure checked, check it correctly, and act upon it in all the ways that we recommend if you want to spare yourself meeting someone like me in a hospital for a cardiovascular complication or worse. And then, I'm glad we came back and summarized, reviewed, and updated this topic. So just as a reminder to folks, we're going to keep doing this. We're going to work through the most important topics we've discussed over the years from the beginning and do this just so that you don't have to go scrolling way back to episode one and take it from the beginning. But as you mentioned, I believe after the new year, these are going to be on the subscriber feed. So recommend checking that out if you want to catch all the future episodes of Teaching Rounds.
If you want to catch the future episodes of Teaching Rounds, you want to support what we do here at Barbell Medicine, subscribing to Barbell Medicine Plus is a great option to do that. And we appreciate your support as always. This has been the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. Special thanks to Dr. Austin Baraki for joining us on episode 320 of the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, we'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Hi, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, founder of Barbell Medicine, and over the last 10 plus years in business, we've built a team of amazing professionals that includes physicians, physical therapists, dietitians, and strength coaches that are available to help you reach your goals. Whether it's strength and muscle gain, weight management, or recovering from an injury, we have some of the best coaches in the game and have worked with people from all walks of life. From teens to grandparents and beginners to elite level athletes, our experienced team of professionals work together to meet you where you're at and give you what you need to succeed. That's the Barbell Medicine difference. If you're not sure exactly what you need, take the quiz linked in the description below or send us an email, support@barbellmedicine.com, and we'll get you sorted. From all of us here at Barbell Medicine, we look forward to hearing from you. We'd love to help.